Well, for this third and final panel, I'm delighted to be joined by four more experts in their field, and given the limitation on time, I'll be very brief on each of their stellar CVs. To my right, we have Rosalind Byrne, who's a partner in McCann Fitzgerald, then Felomy Rafter, who's general counsel in Western Union, then Kira Sharkey, who's general counsel in Credit Suisse, and then we've got Tony Katz, who's a partner in DLA Piper, and he's based in their London office, and we're grateful to Tony for coming over for the conference. So if I can start with you, Tony, we know that in the United Kingdom you've had the CNR regime since 2016, and I understand that there has in fact been a regulatory enforcement action against Mr. Jez Staley, who's Chief Executive Officer of Barclays Bank. Can you tell us a little bit about that action?
So yes, absolutely, and delighted to be here. Thank you very much, John. So the Staley proceedings is actually interesting. Obviously, there have been two proceedings, but it's useful because it brings up many of the themes I think we've been discussing today. So the first proceedings, which was the one about the uncovering of the whistleblower, it turned out from his previous employer, JP Morgan, there was a question about an allegation was made, an anonymous tip-off at least, to Barclays originally, which said actually there were some concerns about an employee and the involvement of Jez. And that came in, and he passed that on to compliance, and then there was a second one which came in, wasn't anonymous, came in from an employee. And he would say there was a bit of a misunderstanding, but the effect was Staley directly took steps through the appointment of a security officer to try uncover a whistleblower. And we probably all sit here and know that trying to uncover whistleblowers is probably not what you should be doing. And that led to an investigation. And the question was, what does the regulator do? This is a CEO of obviously a very, very significant bank, and what was the failing? So ultimately there was a fine, a very significant fine, just over $640,000 in respect of Staley. But the regulator, I think very interestingly in that situation, obviously talking about conflicts, talking about responsibility, did not conclude that he was unfit, that he lacked integrity to continue. So talked about a number of failings, in terms of conflict of interest and sort of managing systems, but did not find that he was unfit to continue, and therefore he did continue. And obviously that does pick up some themes we've talked about, actually, even though there's a finding against an individual, they can continue in the industry. Obviously, the interesting is, since, as we know, he's no longer the CEO of Barclays, because there was a second piece of action which happened, and that's really about his dealings with Epstein, which is also very SMCR related, and the question is whether he had made full disclosure to the bank and therefore to the regulator about his dealings, his interactions with Epstein. He said it was just professional. It turned out there was about just over 1,000 emails which went over a four-year period. Now that investigation is still continuing, and he has stepped down on the basis that he can defend himself in those proceedings. But that raises certainly interesting in terms of senior manager responsibility, because he clearly that on the second one, it's clear that he couldn't continue in that role.
And of course, what's particularly interesting about the first of those inquiries, the whistleblowing focused one rather than the Epstein related one, I understand is that a lot of the criticism by the FCA and the PRA was around his record keeping of conversations that he may have had with compliance, and the suggestion he didn't speak to the right people at the right time, and in particular didn't record the reasons for his particular decision to proceed or not to proceed with his own personal inquiry. What was the industry reaction to that finding, bearing in mind that when you stand back and look at the the conduct by Mr. Staley, it didn't result in any customer losses or affect the bank's financial position?
That's correct. And in terms of obviously keeping records, it turned on very specific facts in the situation. Two different whistleblowers. He has a version which he thought, having spoken to the compliance officer, that he was given the clear that the investigation was closed and therefore he was able to continue and appointed an undercover agent to uncover. But yes, certainly I think the view of the industry is the difficulties of when there are allegations which may question whether it goes to integrity or not, and the difficult of finding a landing about whether someone is fit or not fit, or whether there's, and that's really sort of a common issue we find in the industry at the moment, where there's so many different investigations, some are personal issues, some are professional issues, and some are non-customer issues, how a bank, our financial services industry takes a view further, make assessment on fitness, and whether their assessment will coincide with the regulator's assessment.
And looking at the conduct standards more generally, Ciara, what do you think the impact of this regime is going to be on the day-to-day life of directors and senior officers, and particularly around governance issues?
Yeah, thanks, John, and good afternoon, everybody. I think we're going to see two key shifts here. First, a requirement for directors to adhere and acknowledge regulatory issues as and when they arise. And secondly, I think we'll see a shift in governance to a more evidence-based approach. So what does that mean in practical terms? It means preparation, distribution of meaningful minutes to boards. It means intense preparation by directors ahead of meetings. It means robust discussion and challenge of topics at board meetings. And it also means follow-through and tracking of any matters or actions arising. I'd be of the opinion that minutes will become an evidence tool and will form part of a broader chain of evidence that directors will need to use and rely on in order to show their adherence to their obligations under SEER. I also think that firms need to look and map the roles of directors quite broadly. So, I mean, a lot of boards will have INED sitting on them who will bring particular specialist expertise to the board. I think that firms need to track the role of each board member, including the INEDs, and not just simply focus on the executive members.
And Felmy, what's your view on how life's going to be different for directors and senior executives?
Well, it sounds like it's going to be very good for some of the lawyers in this room.
Yeah, I think so.
It's going to be a big challenge. We're already seeing for firms that the increase in kind of heavily supplemented legislation by reference to kind of regulatory technical standards and CBI or other regulatory guidance is adding an awful lot of expectation onto the kind of administrative burden for firms. And so exactly as I think Ciara has said, you're looking at levels of additional record keeping and governance beyond what you have now. I mean, you know, you mentioned some of the kind of governance at the board level, but I think you're talking about governance and record keeping at a kind of a management level way beyond that. And that's already a very heavy burden on senior managers. Within firms, we're grappling with, in our firm, for example, at the moment, not only have we got the detailed EBA and CBI outsourcing guidance, but we've just kicked off a big operational resilience project. We've got major AML packages coming in. So I think it's going to be a very heavy lift. And I think the other thing, which was an interesting point that I think Lisa mentioned earlier, she talked about the kind of emotional consequences of this. For me, there's a big people issue here. It's going to result in significant exposure and liability, both personally and to the firms. And we've talked about a lot of the issues already today that's going to give rise to. But I think there's going to be a major talent acquisition and retention challenge for firms coming up, because particularly people who maybe are more senior in their career or maybe coming towards the end of their career are probably very well qualified to take on a role, but they may decide that the juice is not worth the squeeze, as they say, and there's just going to be so much additional red tape and responsibility that they may find that it's no longer an attractive proposition.
And if following on from some of the points that Lane made by reference to the poll that was conducted at their event, is there an impression that although Ireland has decided to go for a best-in-class system of regulation against, when you view it against international standards, that Ireland is putting itself at a competitive disadvantage to other European jurisdictions, which are a bit slower at adopting this type of model?
Well, it's certainly been an issue for us in terms of looking at where we house our licenses around region, is that you're looking at a number of different factors, and one of those will be the general quality of talent and attractiveness and the business sophistication of the financial services sector in the market. It'll also relate to how the regulators perceived. And I do think that while there's obviously a potential gain in terms of conduct standards, you do have to weigh that up against the additional burden across all those other areas, and that is something the firms will look carefully at.
And if we turn then to trying to predict what the regulator's approach is going to be, Rosaline, you do a lot of work for the central bank, and I know you're not speaking for the central bank and can't speak for the central bank, but what do we know about the central bank's intended approach to enforcement under the legislation when it comes to...
Thank you, John, and hello, everybody. Well, I mean, the central bank has said publicly earlier this year that they will take a targeted and proportionate approach to enforcement, and I suppose that begs the question, what does that mean? And if you're to kind of deconstruct that, I suppose targeted, you would expect that to mean that enforcement efforts or enforcement resources would be focused on cases where there's quite an identifiable kind of misconduct or something that falls short of the standards that are expected in a very kind of clear way, at least perhaps at the outset of the enforcement regime. And then proportionate, I mean, the central bank has also said very clearly publicly that enforcement tools are just one of the tools in its kind of toolkit for you know, supervision and regulation, and that enforcement is kind of at the top of the tree of a kind of an escalation process. And that being so, coupled with the kind of reference to proportionate action, you would expect enforcement under this regime to be focused on cases where there's a real consumer detriment or, you know, consumer harm, or perhaps where there's something that, you know, where parties or the firm or the individual has been reckless as to the potential consumer harm. Or the other side of it, the other, I suppose, element of harm is where there's potential for harm to the financial system and the integrity of the system. So I think based on what the bank has said about, you know, target and proportionate approach, that's what I think we could expect an enforcement programme to look like.
And that, of course, would chime with the stated philosophy underpinning the bill, which all goes back, I think, to the 2018 report on behaviour and conduct and culture in the industry, and this idea of having a customer focused approach. So if enforcement, particularly against individuals, is reserved for cases where customers, all the more so consumers, are harmed by the conduct, then that would chime with the underlying purpose.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, if we can move on then to look at this issue around compliance and reasonable steps. So the directors and senior executives have to take any reasonable steps to ensure that the firm avoids a contravention. So, Ciara, if I can ask you this question, the Act provides for the central bank issuing guidelines around what reasonable steps are in particular circumstances. What would your expectation be, first of all, around the quality of those guidelines, and what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the guidelines are going to be crucial. I mean, that goes without saying. That's going to be the practical implementation for firms of SEER. I think the CBI will need to engage with the industry in a meaningful way, and equally the industry will need to actively engage with the CBI in that process. I think a natural comparator here is the SMCR in the UK, and of course the CBI has said that SEER will be based on the SMCR. We know that the FCA published practical and informative guidelines for firms over there. That's helped firms align with the expectations of the regulator, and it's allowed for a uniform application of the SMCR in the UK. I think industry expectation here is that we will have similar clear and practical guidelines for Irish firms to follow. And I think, of course, as part of the consultation with the process with the CBI, we can also look to the UK for any lessons learned as part of their implementation. With all of that in mind, I think firms can start preparing now with the bill having issued force here. A lot of firms who are clients of people here will be starting out on their quarter four reviews of the processes, controls and procedures. And I would be saying to clients, you know, look at those reviews with a SEER lens. So, you know, what does the process entail? Are there any improvements that could be made, and test it? And I think that will really help firms engaging with the CBI as part of the consultation, because they will be engaging through tested and practical lens. And of course, it will also put firms on the front foot for compliance with SEER when it comes in down the line, expected sometime next year.
And Tony, as regards the UK experience, what has the industry experience been over there with regard to the quality of FCA and other guidelines that they have to rely on?
So, John, I think a lot of the apprehension we're talking about at the moment certainly was apprehension in the UK. Obviously, the way the UK implemented, I guess, a few features. One is it did it on a progressive basis, started with certain firms, the bigger firms, and moving to the smaller firms over time. So the learnings were through the progressive. So the banks were and the big insurers were the guinea pigs, and therefore they put the systems in place. And when smaller firms were getting down to consumer credit firms, the wider firms have learnt of the expertise and how the bigger firms had implemented it. Secondly, the regulator, I think, was good in terms of putting out a fair bit of guidance. There's a extensive guidance about each of the areas, about what the responsibility map statements of responsibility references, what the conduct rules look like in particular industries. And they set out, for example, they set out what it would mean for themselves. So they imposed and put the responsibility map for the regulator, for the FCA, and they explained what it looked like in terms of division. So I think the feature is, although there was a lot of apprehension, would this chase people out of the industry, to be scared to take on, I don't think that actually has happened. So I think the practical feature, people have accepted it. There's a bit of a danger of doing it. There's a lot more documentation, probably. That's probably the main. There's been an enormous amount of documentation to justify positions, and particularly on taking over positions, because as you're taking over position, you want to be comfortable that you say what the your predecessor, where they got to. And I think probably in reality, we all know, one's all a little bit more vulnerable at the first stage of a new role, where you don't really haven't got on top of things. The issues may arise during the first 3, 6 months, a year period, where you haven't really implemented the changes you would want to. And I think that's where the particular risk is. And I think there's also some concern about more firms where there are known errors. And I think people have been a little bit more reluctant to go into that. But I think over time, I think what I would probably say is the confidence level has increased, and people have become reasonably accustomed now, and using the benefit of the industry's knowledge and equally the regulatory guidance.
And Felamy, what are your thoughts on this idea of acting in accordance with the guidelines and an enforcement process following in terms of proportionality and in terms of evaluating, let's say, a senior executive's conduct in a particular scenario?
Yeah, and the central bank has been generally quite good about commenting. I think we heard a little bit about it early on, that they do want to take quite a proportionate approach. And so I think, again, this is where the guidance becomes important, because what you tend to find is that the individuals, particularly those who maybe don't have kind of a legal background, are the ones, the compliance folk, the people in the risk functions, are the ones getting most nervous about what their exposure might be. So I think that's where understanding more about what the regulator's thought process is around contraventions and enforcement will become quite important. One of the things that we're seeing, for example, is that with an increase in these types of responsibilities, we're having to put in place whistleblowing and other controls at the moment, for example, for the new legislation that's come in there. And I think the concern is that people will become more nervous than even the risk appetite of the firm dictates. And you want to try and get achieve that balance that kind of Tony's referred to, that when it settles down a little bit at the industry level and with the regulator kind of interacting with firms, that you have a more proportionate approach to that. I think overall, at the moment, we're at that nervous stage, and it looks on the face of, you know, a huge amount of both common standards and then actual allocated responsibilities, that you're looking at this, you know, enormously increased onus of responsibility in individuals. Actually, the fundamental standards are not that different to what you have now, but it seems like there will be a lot more specificity around the areas of responsibility that people have. And certainly that's something that we looked at a number of years ago, trying to just move forward with some of the steps that Ciara mentioned in preparing ourselves for this. And even something like coming up with a decision-making framework for individual senior managers from the board and senior management down is a big challenge. So look, we'll see. Hopefully with time, as people get to grips with putting in place the right controls, it will start to settle down.
And if we stay with this idea of reasonable steps, and you take a scenario, Rosaline, where you're acting for a senior executive who is trying to make out a case that she took all reasonable steps. I mean, as looking at it as a litigator, one's immediate thought is, where do I find an expert who's going to back up the proposition that we want to make to the central bank? We all know the difficulties in finding appropriate experts in the Irish market, but more generally, what sort of expert evidence do you foresee is going to be required under the new regime and in this particular new scenario?
Yeah, I think that's going to be very complex because, I mean, as you say, the natural instinct would be to, you know, okay, who can I get to say that what I've done in a certain set of circumstances was a reasonable thing to have done or reasonable steps to have taken? But, you know, you'd have to look at what type of expert you'll get. Do you get a kind of a corporate governance behavioural expert? Do you get somebody that's expert very precisely in the field of decision making that you're in and the sector or the subsector, whether it's funds or insurance or, you know, on a very specific issue? Do you, you know, how do you even go about briefing the expert? I mean, what's the question that you pose them? And we all know that it's good practice, obviously, as litigators, when you're looking for an expert opinion, to ask open questions. And I mean, you know, that in itself could be difficult because with kind of hindsight vision, everybody probably could have done better when you look at everything you do on a daily basis. Speaking for myself, at least, anyway. But, you know, and then is somebody really going to say, you know, you couldn't have done a bit better in the circumstances? And the chances are, if a senior executive has got to the stage where they're the subject of investigation or inquiry by the central bank, you know, there's certain circumstances that give rise to doubt about the conduct. So I think it's going to be difficult. I think it's going to be a difficult scenario. I think what will be very interesting as well, though, if somebody does get an expert and the expert, you know, makes a case for you know, the steps having been reasonable, what the bank or any inquiry member might do in response to that. So, for example, would the regulator take a view? Well, we're the regulator, and in our view, this isn't good enough, and you know, we don't need any expert evidence to back that up, or would they try to get an expert opinion to rebut it? And how are those opinions tested? You know, and then what kind of, if the regulator was to form a view, well, we don't need kind of opposing expert evidence. We're the regulator. We set the standards. This is what we expect. How much kind of deference is given to that position when you have an expert saying something else? So I think it will be interesting to see what kind of experts crop up if people, senior executives look to get expert evidence to you know, to say they've taken reasonable steps in their defence, and then and how that's then responded to by the bank stroke inquiry members.
So it's not going to be enough for the expert simply to say, well, the industry has been doing it like that for years, and that's my experience, you know, which is the, I suppose, the traditional tort law approach to negligence actions.
Yeah.
You're benchmarking it against a broad standard of conduct across a professional class. It's more sophisticated.
Yeah, and actually, sorry, you've reminded me of a point I wanted to make, which is also, you know, if you look back at what had been done in the past, well, is that good enough anymore? You know, and in fact, if we're in a new era of, you know, higher standards being expected, is it a kind of forward-looking point, and does past practice even assist that much?
Yeah, so us lawyers can console ourselves that experts are going to be making lots of money at this as well. Moving on then to the new duty to self-report. So firms will be under a duty to report, as will senior executives, report to the central bank matters that they think the central bank would expect notice of. How's this going to change your life, Ciara?
Oh, that is a good question, John. I mean, I think, look, it goes back to the importance of having clear and workable guidelines for firms in this regard. I would hope that the guidelines would include a materiality framework for firms. I think there's a risk if they don't, or if the bar is set too low, there will be over-reporting by firms. I would suggest that most firms will want to take a conservative approach when it comes to SEER. I'd also hope, similar to what Tony referred to for the FCA guidelines, that there will be, you know, consistent and clear forms of reporting and timelines for firms. This will help provide for a harmonised approach and also a level playing field as we roll out SEER across the regulated institutions in Ireland. Again, I think firms can future-proof here as well. I think firms should consider, and certainly in my role as general counsel, it's what I'd be advising my own firm, they consider any prior engagement they've had with CBI in terms of materiality or breach reporting. Look at what worked and what didn't work for the firm based on the size of the organisation, its risk profile, its risk appetite, etc. I think this will give firms a chance and an idea of what materiality under SEER will look like for them, and will help lawyers and myself as a general counsel advise our clients accordingly based on that framework.
And I suppose, Felamy, it's all very well for general counsel to have an idea as to what she thinks is material, putting oneself in the central bank shoes. But how do you communicate that kind of thought process down the ranks to middle management, lower management, and people at the coalface?
Yeah, I mean, it's simple enough. I mean, what we've done in the past is, I mean, when the 2013 Act came in, that provided for specific disclosure requirements. And I think as you look at the new bill, as I mentioned a minute ago, while there's a lot more specificity about the types of additional supporting things you might have to report, like things like supporting documentation or decision making, the fundamental standard I don't think has really changed. It's what would be material to the bank in the discharge of its function. And so we've kind of looked at that quite carefully. And as Ciara said, we've looked at our engagement in the past with the central bank and other regulators to figure out, well, what would the bank expect us to be reporting on? It's not every single little thing that happens every day of the week, but it's stuff that will be material to the discharge of the bank's main function. And its main function is more focused on systemic issues concerned with the good functioning of the credit system and the banking system under the 1942 Act. So I think the problem that you face is that people who are, again, coming from maybe the business side or areas where they're not so familiar with the regulatory expectations and legislative side are looking at it quite nervously because it looks like an open book to them. So what we've done in the past is we've effectively just provided training for those managers down through the ranks and really just got to grips with getting them comfortable on what the expectations should be. And then after that, I think you have to have good quality policies and procedures in place in terms of internal escalations, internal communications between staff, so that those people who are on top of the relevant functions and the staff reporting to them have a degree of clarity about how reporting should operate and how escalations should operate in practice.
And Tony, there's an equivalent provision in the UK legislation. Has the FCA been inundated with reports, at least at the start, or what's the overall experience been there?
So I think the reporting is probably one of the key practical changes, actually, because what you have, obviously we've always had a responsibility for the firm to report and be open a cooperative and opened and informed the regulator of anything they would reasonably expect. But now this, you also have the obligation for individuals to report. And there's a tension when an issue arises or a potential issue arises. As we know, there's normally a process when for the firm, and we give particular legal advice, no doubt, as part of the process, that one sort of goes through a period of time to investigate the nature of, and then make a decision whether to report. But the individual is often is now aware of their own, clearly aware of their own obligation, and is prompting and saying, well, I simply don't want to take on the risk. I want this to be reported. And therefore, the firm no longer has control over those issues because the individual is pushing for an outcome to be disclosed. So we're seeing that tension play out. And I think then, John, to your point, there is much more reporting which is going on because of that tension.
And I think that brings us very neatly back to the one of the recurrent themes of today is the conflict of interest between the firm and the individual director or senior manager. And Roselyne, wearing your hat as an advisor to the firm, how do you go about managing that potential conflict, or what red flags do you look for when you're starting to advise on a potential investigation?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the things that we would look at, I suppose you would try to identify based on the information available to people at the time of the instruction and the outset, is whether the firm and an individual, or indeed individuals, are going to be aligned in their positions, whether there's potential for them to have a conflict of interest, whether even if there's more than one individual involved, and this can be obviously complex to manage, whether as between those individuals there's potential for a conflict. I suppose, you know, like co-accused in a criminal situation, sorry about the analogy, but so I mean that all has to be looked at. One thing I think that's difficult at the outset of an investigation for everybody in assessing conflicts is everybody doesn't have the same information available to them when they're looking at a conflict situation, so I think you have to be very careful, and if there's any doubt about, you know, potential for conflicting positions, there should be separate advisors or separate teams. And one way to start that off at the outset is sometimes to have different teams within the same firm, but then be ready to be, you know, and to be clear about having to get separate teams if needs be, you know. And I suppose one other thing we see is that, you know, the there's so much more, this has been mentioned earlier today, there's so much more at stake for individuals, you know, and even if there isn't an obvious conflict, they may want to tool up separately with a different team. They may just want to adopt a different approach in their interactions with the regulator.
And Felmy, working for an international organisation as you do, what particular dynamics are there in an international organisation vis-a-vis this potential conflict? How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, this is certainly one of the trickier areas, I think. And we haven't been in the company through from kind of not long after getting its first major kind of license here through to kind of quite a stable, mature governance framework and relationship with the regulator. This is the kind of thing that you need to manage quite carefully for a couple of reasons. One is that you don't want to end up with a ton of parallel processes around how an investigation internally is being handled, because you've got individuals' concerns versus maybe the firm's concerns, where there may be a conflict or different positions there. So that's one thing. You know, it gives rise to obviously all kinds of questions that we've kind of heard about earlier around D&O cover and maybe separate independent legal advice for individuals and all of those implications. But, you know, even things like, do we end up now with additional kind of privileged sessions of board meetings or management meetings where we have to bring in lawyers because we're dealing with sensitivities around conflicts? That's not stuff that we really want. It's not stuff that the regulator wants either, because they don't really want to be asking, for example, for the board papers and then finding out that a huge chunk of them have been redacted because they're privileged. It's not the kind of thing that generates a lot of confidence, and it's not good for the trust relationship. We've talked earlier today about the regulatory relationship is just not the same as managing litigation. There are certain parallels and things that are very helpful from one to the other in terms of managing it. But ultimately, you know, at the end of the day, if the regulator feels like they don't trust what the firm is doing or how it's handling things, then that's going to be a problem for the firm. So I think that's one thing. And then the other point, which is kind of more back to your question about the, you know, operating a subsidiary or multinational environment, that is also a big challenge because, you know, a US parent and the executives at that level may not have the same expectations or appreciation as what the local people working for the subsidiary will have. And so again, if you end up with, you know, numerous processes or spending a huge amount of additional time on managing both individual positions and concerns as well as the firm's concerns, that's going to result in tensions at the senior level as well. And it can be a long road towards getting both the group and the regulator into a stable, mature position where everybody kind of understands what the expectations are and does whatever they need to meet them. So I think that is something that will need to be carefully looked at, yeah.
And Ciara, working in the Ireland branch of a huge international banking group headquartered outside the European Union, what sort of issues do you see coming down the line in terms of this particular problem of conflicts of interest?
Yeah, so I think there's a few things that need to be considered for international organisations. The first one is obvious. It's educating group in the head office of what CIR means for Ireland, what it means for the senior executives based here. In Credit Suisse, we're obviously well down the track on that one, and the publication of the bill has helped. Secondly, to touch on a theme that's kind of been explored throughout the day, which is conflicts of interest. So large international organisations, you may have group directors sitting on your boards in Ireland, and inevitably conflicts of interest will arise. And back to my earlier point on governance, it's going to be really important for those conflicts of interest to be identified, to be declared, to be dealt with, and to be set out in the minutes as part of your evidence bank for compliance. And it's going to be very important to communicate that within group, within the CIR framework. I would also say that support from the head office and from group is going to be very important. I mean, the potential liability under CIR, again, we've discussed this at length today, you know, can be immense for individuals, and support can come in various guises from group. It could even be something as simple as providing additional company secretarial support to ensure kind of robust governance. It could be, you know, liaising with HR teams so that they're aware of the requirements when they're onboarding new employees or directors as part of this year. And finally, I would say if you do have, and this goes without saying, if you do have group directors sitting on your board in an Irish entity, they need to be aware of the requirements for CIR up front. They need to be trained and they need to be educated. That's going to be vital.
Yeah, and when we're talking about board minutes here, I mean, it sounds like it's an art form rather than something which is rote and mechanical, isn't it?
I think to capture
the dialogue, the dissent, the conclusions, the action
discussion,
points.
The challenge. I mean, I think we're moving from, you know, kind of bullet-pointed board minutes to really, you know, getting in there and having that robust challenge, you know, across from the executives, from the INEDs, from the NEDs, really showing that, you know, when a topic comes up, that it has been discussed, that it has been challenged, that questions have been asked around it, and that's going to be the same for large international organisations as it is for anybody based locally in Ireland.
Final round of questions. Inevitably, we have to ask this. In the United Kingdom, did the regime change culture? Can you change culture via legislation?
Maybe just I'll mention one point, John, just on because you on the question of conflict. There's obviously very tangible questions on conflict, because it may be in somebody's responsibility that they believe they need new resources. You need a new financial package because actually you're running as a finance division and you don't feel your systems are correct. But the board doesn't want to allow that money to happen. So we're seeing that real tension taking place between the CFO saying, actually, I want to spend as much money as possible, whereas the board's going to have to push back. And that tension, so obviously that's how you document, and those tensions are very real and come up all the time. Question of culture, has it changed culture? It's certainly intended to change culture. I'm not sure it has quite had the effect yet in terms of changing culture. Maybe the proof in the pudding, in a way, is in the UK, as you know, focusing on UK, there's a whole new regime which is in place. It's all about a consumer duty. And part of the consumer duty, which sits clearly along individuals, is to say, let's put consumer at the heart of everything which is done. That's a whole overlay which is happening over the next 9 months, by the end of July of next year. So I think that to some extent is acknowledgement. The regulator didn't push it. The Parliament pushed it rather than the regulator, but the regulator has embraced it. I think it's to say progress was still needed to be made. There's still lots of practices which I think the regulator would say was not sufficient, sludge practices or the like, or cultural issues. And I think one of the difficulty you have is, as we all know in the industry, it's difficult to be outside the pack. So it's easy to look back and say that was a problem, but if everybody is doing it and everybody's making money from selling insurance, from particular sort of controversies we've seen in the past, it's very difficult when you're operating those organizations to say we shouldn't be doing it, even though everybody else on down the high street is doing that. So I would say probably the answer is, John, I think it made some progress, but I still think there's still a way to go.
And Felmy, you and I discussed beforehand the impact of the regime on risk-taking, and inevitably financial services is an industry where proper and good risk-taking is rewarded, and that's really the name of the game. But what are your impressions on how the regime is going to impact on risk appetite?
Yeah, I think as we mentioned before, it's going to be important that once people have a better handle on their responsibilities and those are mapped out more clearly, that you don't end up in a situation where people's decision-making, you know, for example, there's an additional, I think, requirement now that there'll be a participation in collective decision making. You don't want this, it's a bit like you don't want groupthink at the board level. You don't want a situation where people are participating in collective decision making that's actually at a level that's completely risk averse to the risk appetite of the firm. So that's not to say you should be taking additional risks, but equally, you know, you are trying to run a business. So I think that's a challenge. I think just to kind of add to Tony's point, I have the pleasure of being the legal representative for our consumer duty project for our UK sub at the moment, which is an absolute nightmare. And the FCA has kindly produced the most vague principles-based piece of guidance you could possibly wish for. But I think it does give rise to a really interesting dynamic that we're currently grappling with. And I think it does go to this question of culture, is that you really need to get buy-in across all the functions, and especially the first-line business. And if you can't have a situation to deal with this consumer duty effectively where the second lines are being really just told, well, it's just another consumer compliance project, so you guys just go and figure that out and sort that out. You need buy-in from everybody across the business. And I think really it's the same for this. You're going to have to see it from the top down. It'll have to be lived by the CEO and the board members. Not just from they will do it from an individual, you know, cover your ass perspective, because they're going to be worried about accountability, but it needs to be a bit more than that. It needs to be kind of consumer-based and kind of outcomes-based for better conduct by the firm, rather than just because we were told we had to do it.
Okay, thanks. That's great. Okay, well, I think we've got a little bit of time for any questions or comments. You're all dying for a drink. Oh, we have a question there. Thanks. Brian.
Brian Clark from Maples. Thanks very much for the very informative discussions. Just a couple of observations. There's been a lot of discussion about walking the line between a criminal process and another process, if I put it like that. I'm probably sitting on the naughty step beside Rob Kane in the central bank for asserting certain rights. But I do think that we have to be careful about how we go forward. And I don't know if any of our central bank colleagues are here. But asserting rights and putting forward positions on behalf of your clients shouldn't be seen as being obfuscation or improper. And in fact, I think the bill probably recognises some of the issues that have come up over the last number of years. The second observation, I think, is just out of the discussion that took place before, which is about the whole conflicts point and the issues that arise. And we all need to be alive at the whole, to the old ex terpi causa rule, which I know John loves dearly.
And Elizabeth.
And Elizabeth, indeed. And for those of you who are not familiar with it, it's the rule that you can't profit or be compensated for your own wrongdoing. And that does come up a lot in this context, particularly where the case law is not that well settled. It comes up in the DNO context. And I think for those of us, at least on the poacher side of the fence, we're often faced with dealing with the other old legal, lesser known maxim, which is you can't put the shit back in the donkey. And really, when you're faced with an assertion that either something has or has not happened, or you've breached a level or a restriction, very often you're in the conflict of saying, well, we have to admit that now because we might get the 30% discount. But it seems to me that now, with the new regime and the potential for liability coming down the line for individuals, that actually only heightens the issue of the conflict, and we need to be alive to that.
Thanks. I think we'll look for the Latin version of that second phrase when we go back to our desks. Thanks, Brian. Any other questions? Or we've got a question here. If you could just wait for the
respond to what Brian's saying. I think that does go back, though, to really getting clarity from the bank as things mature on both its guidance, technical guidance, but also their expectations at a supervisory level. Because it's one thing if the bank decides from a policy perspective, we're going to start hammering into individuals, and I don't believe that that's their intention, but it's quite another thing if they really do give useful, you know, reasonable, proportionate guidance on expectations, because I think that will help address those issues.
Okay, thanks.
Again, Brian Dalton. The Dutch Central Bank pioneered certain approaches to doing cultural audits, and that was cited by the Central Bank as a framework that they'd possibly use. Has that been applied at all in Ireland in terms of using that framework to assess the robustness of the culture in any of the financial institutions? Is anybody aware of that?
Well, if I can just take that, I'm not sure. What I do know is that I referred to the 2018 report into behaviour, so I understand from that report, having read it, that the team from the Dutch Central Bank worked very closely with the Irish Central Bank in terms of evaluating the culture as it stood and the approach to compliance and behaviour generally. And of course, that was a multidisciplinary team with behavioural psychologists, and it wasn't just regulators and lawyers. But beyond that, I'm not aware of any direct involvement by the Dutch Central Bank after that report.
They tend to focus on industry questionnaires and Dear CEO letters, where they either seek additional input at a general industry level rather than going to a firm and having a kind of a firm-specific review. They were setting up a consumer-specific division which was going to do more industry-specific and firm-specific, I think, audits and kind of reviews of consumer behaviour. But generally speaking, we haven't really seen that. They've kind of stuck with their main PRISM supervisory inspection model. And then, as I say, it's more the questionnaires and the industry Dear CEO guidance that's come out.
Yeah, I'd say to add to that as well, I mean, you're totally right, Fiona Mee. Maybe sometimes it's part of the FRAS that the CBI conduct. I think culture would form part of that and would be a key part for the central bank in assessing the institution as a whole. But I haven't seen any kind of targeted you know, inspections or investigations around that.
Hi. On that point of culture, I think the independent non-executive directors are a really great place to start to understand is legislation going to change the culture of an organisation. I mean, I was in a situation recently where there was two lawyers negotiating the INED contract for the applicant firm, and I'm on the other side with my lawyer, and it just suddenly dawns on you that this is not a great situation to be in. Is that a relationship and a culture you want to actually go into? Now, I'm not going to point fingers and say, you know, who's to blame and all the rest there, but the INEDs are really valuable. But the trick I'm finding at the moment is mapping the responsibilities, because one of the documents that we sign is when we become an INED is that we know everything there is to know about the Central Bank Acts and Companies Acts. We have to map that, prove that, and then be trained on those sort of things. And then suddenly culture gets lost in the reeds, because we're all trying to demonstrate more of a tick box compliance attitude. And then the compliance debate begins to slip. Well, the debate stays there, but the living of the compliance attitude, culture attitude, begins to slip every day. So I'm just curious, you know, how do you keep that cultural point at the forefront while you're running this exercise?
Yeah, I can go with that. And I think you've touched on your last point there. It is keeping it at the forefront within the particular institution. You're right, it can kind of get lost in the mix between legal and regulatory obligations, but I think it's incumbent on the firm, senior management and the board of directors to always have culture front and centre, whether that's through training, whether it's having it as a regular agenda item at board meetings, whether it's bringing HR or the corporate culture teams in to present to directors so that they're front and centre of what the culture is. And I'm not sure how you can serve on a board of directors of an institution without really being keenly aware of what the culture of the institution is and what direction it needs to take. So it's a very intangible concept. I mean, how do you assess culture risk? How do you show it? It needs to be inbuilt in the institution. It needs to be front and centre.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the INED role is absolutely key, and I think that's, we haven't touched upon it that much today versus, say, a general NED or the other PCF specifically, but the INEDs obviously are front and centre in all of this, because they're kind of, in a way, the independent interface and kind of mediator in some respects with the regulator as to how the firm is doing on things like culture and conduct. So when they then acquire a series of significant increased common and allocated standard responsibilities, That's something we need to manage, because we don't want people, who would be very good INEDs no longer feeling like they want to take on that work. I think that's an important piece. And then, as Kira says, at a practical level, what we tend to find is having INEDs who chair our subcommittees of the board, like the audit committee and the risk and compliance committee, is very helpful. And then maybe executive sessions with the board and the chair separately, and just a general cadence of interaction between the chairperson and the INEDs is really helpful, so that the chair and the CEO have a kind of a line of communication where they get that independent viewpoint, and that it's that can really help inform culture and conduct, I think.
And remember, as an INED, I mean, you are independent. If you're feeling you're not seeing that within, an organisation that you're sitting on, you can drive that, you can bring it up, you can look to map it.
From time to time.
It can be a bit lonely, yeah.
The joys of being an INED. it's absolutely, I think as Sarah comes in, it is going to be incumbent to Fela-Me's point, INEDs are going to play a really key role in boards, and it's kind of back to my own earlier point where I'm saying their roles also need to be mapped and documented, as well as the executives. And so, depending on the organisation, you can drive that change as best you can. It's all you can do.
So I guess actually from a UK perspective, we didn't have that actually. So the actual senior management didn't focus on the non-executives. It's not a prescribed function. So it's not part of the responsibility map in the same way. It is depending if one's a chair, if one's the head of the audit or head of risk, but it's not per se a separate responsibility. So it doesn't fit neatly into the responsibility map. So that didn't change the culture. Maybe that feeling that comes, to the question of now we have something called a consumer champion, which has to be part of to be thinking about all consumer issues on the board, ensure that that's raised, but that actually didn't come through this process.
Interesting. Yeah.
Thank you. Marion Kelly, I'm CEO of the Banking Culture Board. I was just going to come back on the point that this gentleman mentioned over there. So the behaviour and culture review that the central bank did, they were requiring, certainly from the pillar banks, they were getting updates regularly on how the findings and that were being addressed over the last number of years. But it's our understanding from discussions with the central bank that they have now developed a supervisory toolkit for behaviour and culture inspections. And that is due to be started to be piloted early next year. I think it was delayed because of the switching and the exit of Ulster Bank and KBC, but our understanding is it'll start next year.
Thanks very much. So I think we will wind up this panel session. Many thanks indeed to Tony, to Kira, Felimi and Rosaline. That was absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much. And then just by way of closing the conference, just a couple of words on some themes that have emerged. Judge Butler mentioned the transparency of the legislation. John, I think you're going to be working on a consolidated Central Bank Act again fairly soon, but clearly there's an issue around transparency and accessibility to the legislation, particularly for individuals. The whole topic of conflicts of interest is one we're going to have to watch play out. It's a good thing that the investigation process, which is currently informal, is going to be structured. Another big theme is it worth it being a senior manager, a senior executive or a director? Is it worth the anxiety? What do you have to do in order to get the necessary comfort from your employer that you're going to be, that they're going to have your back if the central bank issues an enforcement process against you? Another interesting theme is the dynamics around settlement. Really interesting to hear the disincentives to settling with the central bank and the challenges in that regard. And then in terms of those of us who are always interested in legal challenges to legislation, the whole issue of equality of arms and the privilege around self-incrimination is obviously going to play out. So I want to thank Aoife Kinnearney and all of her team, including Melissa Nakanjerwa and Therese Barry, who worked tirelessly behind the scenes to make this happen. This didn't happen by magic. I want to thank the FSBA committee for the support that they've given to the project. We're extremely grateful to Judge Nuala Butler. Very grateful indeed to all of our panelists and all of our speakers. And many thanks to you, dear audience, for coming along. And I'm pleased to say that there's a drinks reception in the sheds. If you don't know where the sheds are, you won't get lost. It's through that door. And if you do get lost, just follow any barrister who's gravitating towards it, because it is 5:45 after all. Thank you very much indeed.